Calling the meeting to order. Any member of the public may speak on any item which is on the agenda. The board will only allow comments by members of the public on any item on the agenda during consideration of the item. When the item is called, please raise your hand and the chair will recognize you. The general public at the beginning of the regular agenda during the public comment period may address matters under the jurisdiction of the board and not on the posted agenda. However, any person wishing to make a presentation must submit their issue in written form with copies furnished to board members. Presentations will be limited to 3 minutes. Okay,
Lynn Betancourt, Maria DeAnda,
here.
Jim DeMartini,
here.
Mike Fisher,
here.
Gordon Ford,
Jagan again.
Jagan is here in his stead. Darren Garrett,
here.
Mike Lynch, Ron Martin, Clarence Willman, Linda Stotts Burnett. We have a quorum. Where are we?
Announcements.
You just want to announce that Jagan Reha, is that correct?
Yes, Raja.
Raja, sorry. Assistant Treasurer Tax Collector, Deputy for Gordon Ford is sitting in on the meeting today.
Is this going to be, are you going to be doing it on a regular basis or?
That's up to him.
So today is your day.
Yes.
Well, welcome.
Thank you.
Okay, any public comments? Okay, consent items?
Make a motion to approve the consent items as listed on the agenda.
Second.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Any discussion? Okay, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, the semi-annual performance by OSB.
Like the public comment, am I allowed 3 minutes, or do you want?
No, that's only if you presented an item before.
Good to be here this afternoon. Again, Keith Brooke with LSV, and it's been a couple of meetings since I've been here in person. We've done it over the phone, so good to see everyone. I'll just spend 10 or 15 minutes to give you an update on the organization, the portfolio, the how we're structured, some of the changes that have gone on, and open it up with questions. But as always, if there's questions that kind of touch on some of those items, please let me know. The white blue cover. So if you wouldn't mind opening up to the first tab, a couple of pages on the organization. The good news is not much has changed. Not much new to report since we last talked. Ownership, no changes on the way that we're structured. The general partnership, you'll remember, with 16 of the partners sharing in the ownership of that firm, plus a partner that helped us get started as a minority stakeholder. At the end of the first quarter, you'll see that assets were at about $58.3 billion, with about $17 billion broadly in EFA, or in your case, EFA plus emerging markets, you know, these kind of broad international strategies. So important part of our business. Flows have been fairly steady. We haven't seen a whole lot of either flows in or out of this strategy, but client base has been very stable. So we haven't seen a lot of movement there. A little bit more last year, some early in the year, some reallocation to equities in our strategies, and unlike and no different than what you're going through right now, maybe reallocating back to targets and maybe a little net outflows more recently. So with the big run up that we've seen in the market, page two is the organizational structure, and should look very familiar to you with Joseph Lukanishak in the middle of the page. Head of the firm, founding partner, still involved in all aspects of our business. No changes to the investment team, same roles and responsibilities with the group. No departures. We did hire a new compliance analyst, so just continuing to add some names, some folks in that area. But on the investment team, again, no changes to personnel there, responsibilities. Questions on the organization or business for us? Okay. Under tab two, is a couple of pages on performance as well as the portfolio. And on page 5 is a relationship summary. So where we got started we're up to almost 6 years now. So the portfolio began, see on the right-hand side of the page, in September of 2004. And at the end of March, the portfolio stood at about $140 million. You'll recall that we are a quantitative manager, so we use quantitative models to try to rank stocks and construct portfolios. And we'll see in the next couple of pages our deep value bias that we have. We're a deep value manager. We like cheap stocks that have done struggled a bit but are showing some signs of improvement. Has paid off in the last year. This recovery that we've seen in the markets, we've fully participated in that, and we've seen a nice rebound in your portfolio. Page 6 is just a couple of numbers, just that looking at the international markets, the indices, and we'll go into a great amount of detail here, but just a couple of points for background for a discussion of the performance of your portfolio. Obviously, over the last year, and these are periods ending March 31, you've seen a nice rebound in the equity markets. The EAFE markets have been up about 55%. Value's done a little bit better. When you look at value stocks, up almost 59%. So these stocks that had been beaten up, that had struggled in 2007, 2008, in the materials area, the industrials, bounced back and recovered. Did fairly well. Also, smaller names did well last year, oftentimes coming out of a tough period, recessionary period, some of the smaller names that lead the market, and that was the case not only in the U.S., but outside the U.S. You see the S&P develop U.S., not ex-U.S. small cap up nearly 70% over the last year. Emerging markets, as you well know, did extremely well, up more than 80%, and about 20% of your portfolio is invested in emerging markets. And that's equal to what the benchmark is. So we take the benchmark that we're given, which is the basically all the countries, both developed and emerging, with the exception of the United States, and basically weight them to how the capitalization and how important and how big they are relative to others. And the benchmark provides us that information. So we're fairly close from a country standpoint. Again, about 20%. Of your portfolio would have been invested in emerging. Page 7, we show performance a couple of different ways. We have gross and net numbers. First of all, the first line is gross of fees, the next is net of fees. Your fees average about 60 basis points approximately. And the top group, we have the annualized periods, the first quarter, 1 year, 3 years, 5 years, and then the 5 3/4 years over on the right-hand side of the page since inception. Then the annual periods down at the bottom, which give you a little bit of a view of kind of year over year what we've seen. Your portfolio in the first quarter, just a short time period, was up just over 1.7-1.8%, and kind of in line with the benchmark. So nothing too exciting there. Over the last year, as I alluded to, you've had a nice rebound. In the portfolio, up about 72-73% versus 60 for the benchmark. Again, the things that helped us, one, sticking to our discipline. It was difficult to be a value manager for a bit there. It was difficult to be any equity manager for 07 or 08 with the markets really tough. But it was the value stocks, the cheap stocks on price to earnings, price to cash flow, those type of measures that really struggled, and that's where we tend to like to buy and hold over a 3 to 4 year period. Well, we got some rebound last year in those names, and so it was kind of style to a certain extent. We also like the smaller names, and we do have a little bit of a bias toward some mid-cap names in your portfolio. That was helpful. And it also came down to good stock selection. So individual names, it wasn't necessarily that we were real overweight a particular sector like financials or materials. It was more individual stock by stock that helped last year. Now, since inception, we're essentially even with the benchmark. So we've had a we've kind of clawed our way back last year from a couple of about 18 months of weak performance, but over a long period of time, you know, we have seen where styles kind of go in and out of favor more often than not. We've been able to add some value, and we hope that we're on that path with this improvement last year. Any questions on performance?
I have a question.
Yes.
On page 11, mm-hmm. Under the country-wise, under India, there's a portfolio by Satyam Computer Services. Do
yes.
you see that?
Yes.
I believe that in January of 2009, this company went very bad name, and even World Bank blacklisted this company not to enter in the World Bank. And the even Indian government has some arrangements because the overall accounting principle was totally wrong.
Okay.
Any information on that?
I don't know. I'm not aware of that. That's something we can check with. I can check with our portfolio managers, and we're if there is some headline news, it may be a stock that we've invested in, and there is, whether it be Goldman Sachs or a situation like that where there's some issues with accounting, oftentimes we will, if we're already holders of that stock, we will kind of hold on to it and see what happens. And on the next rebalance, when we go through, we'll evaluate that name. We may just put it on a hold list and not either buy any more or sell any until kind of the dust settles. But I'm not familiar with that. But that's something that can check into, and we'll send a note back to Tom or Henry and copy all of
the
it.
The chairman is in jail now in India.
Oh yeah.
And then he bribed some of the officials in the World Bank, and they blacklisted their company. But that was sold out to. I think that was sold out to Tata Consultancy Services, okay. If I'm wrong. Some other company took over.
Yeah, took it
yeah.
over.
Okay.
And that could be the case. Yeah. So.
Okay.
Any other questions on just performance? Why don't we turn to page 8 and 9, touch on how the portfolio is structured right now and some of the changes that went on, and then we'll see what other questions you might have. Your portfolio is on the left side of the page with some of the kind of important measures that we pay attention to: price to earnings, price to cash flow, price to book. These valuation measures that over time predict returns. And being more heavily weighted to low price cash flow measures, low high dividend yield stocks, and so forth. That's kind of the tenets of our process. We still think, even though markets have been up, or your portfolio has been up 70, almost 80%, that we're off such depressed levels, and earnings have improved to a certain extent, that portfolio is still relatively inexpensive. If you look out fiscal year 2 earnings, which is looking out at 2011 earnings, the portfolio is trading at about 10 times earnings. If you look out at next year's earnings, it's about 12 times earnings. So not too expensive when we look at relative to history. Look at measures like price to cash flow of 6.5 times. Historically, portfolios have traded at more 8-9 times cash flow, so still reasonably attractive. And then a dividend yield of about 3.5%, so 3.6% dividend yield that your portfolio is paying to just wait and sit. So a bit of a discount relative to the benchmarks, and that's typically what you'll see with us. So again, it's been a big run, and we've acknowledged that, but we're not market timers. We don't have anything in our process that, from a top-down view, kind of makes us either more or less excited about the market. But what is more interesting, and what does kind of occur with our bottom-up stock selection process, is that we tend to have focus in different areas, different sectors of the market. If you turn to page 9, you can see a chart on the left-hand side of the page, which is your portfolio broken out by the broad sectors. Your portfolio is in the dark blue. The light blue is your primary benchmark, the ACWI XUS. And what we've seen in the last 12 months is that a number of areas of the market where we had either equal weights or exposed had more weight than the benchmark, such as consumer discretionary, materials, industrials. Those segments have run and done well. We've traded and sold some of those names and redeployed the proceeds into what we would consider more stable companies, more stable segments of the economy. Stocks that have more or less been somewhat left behind in this run-up, areas like consumer staples, grocery stores, healthcare, pharmaceuticals, even utilities, where we had a fairly big underweight. We're seeing more more value in utility companies right now. So essentially, stocks that have been up 100, 120, 150% became more expensive. They drop in ranking the way we look at things. And we've redeployed those, as I said, in the staples where we have about 8% of your portfolio, healthcare where we have about a 4% overweight relative to the benchmark, and to say utilities. So a shift in the portfolio, but not a lot of trading. We still, portfolio turnover was about 30-35% last year, so we tend to hold these names for 3 or 4 years, so it wasn't as if we went from turning the portfolio over 20-30% a year to 100% turnover. But there was a bit of a rotation out of these more economically sensitive sectors into these more stable segments of the market. So we're a little bit defensive, I would say, right now, if you looked at the portfolio, more defensively positioned than we were at this point last year. But again, not a statement from a firm view. It's more from a bottom-up, where are we finding the most attractive securities. Let me stop there and see if there's any questions, either in regards to the firm, performance, anything that might address. No?
I'm an inquisitive group today.
Put you to sleep already. Okay?
Going in the right direction?
Yes.
I have a question on your page 10. Just out of curiosity, mm-hmm. The country weighting, the emerging markets, that's such a variety of different types of countries and political situations and whatnot. Is there any, how do you determine which stocks you invest in those types of countries versus the more stable or the non-emerging? Yeah. Just out of curiosity.
Yeah, we use essentially the same process and the same model. We found in looking at the emerging markets, we don't invest in frontier markets, which would be some African nations, the Middle East. We get good information, good data from Brazil, China, Russia. There's a few countries in here that fall under the benchmark that are just so small we don't have any exposure to. Morocco, Peru, some of those areas. But we use the same basic idea that these cheap stocks on different multiples, and we do get good information, good data from the data vendors that have done poorly over a long period of time, are showing some improvement. So it's the same model that we use, and it's been, we found it effective. In fact, last year with our emerging markets only strategy, that from a relative standpoint was our best strategy. So our emerging selection, the model, if you will, work best in emerging. We have an easy way to quantify why that's the case, but the same basic tenets seem to apply there. Now, in the emerging, I will point out that we do tend to like, again, similar to in the developed markets, those second tier names. So it's not going to be the biggest names in the benchmark that are exciting to us, like Petrobras, exactly. Some of the big Far East companies that make up some of the bigger parts of the benchmark. It is topical. Just so you see on this page, Greece and Portugal. We do have a little bit of exposure there. Greece was downgraded today. That's S&P downgraded both Greece and Portugal, their debt. And, markets have sold off, obviously, in respect to that. We don't have much exposure, 12 basis points in Greece, so probably one name, one small name, and a little bit of exposure to Portugal. So benefits of being, I guess, diversified to a certain extent. But we don't have an opinion on those necessarily the country type of factors. Anything else? We're good? If not, I appreciate your patience through the rough patch of 07 and 08, and hopefully we see the continued improvement in the portfolio. Thanks.
Thank you.
Next, we have the annual performance report by Pyramus. Standing in the corner.
Well, good afternoon. On behalf of Pyramus, which is the institutional money management platform at Fidelity Investments, thanks for having us in. While the telephonic process is quite efficient, it is quite nice to be in front of folks and see real people and field real questions and actually know who's asking them. So thank you for having us in. By way of brief introduction, my name is Art Greenwood. I'm responsible for relationship management and client service for our public pension plans here in California. I'm joined today by my longtime colleague, Mike Strong. Mike is the lead portfolio manager for the International Growth Strategy. We have managed the strategy for Stan Sara since May of 06, so we're sort of wrapping up our fourth year here pretty soon. Your portfolio at the end of the first quarter was about $133 million in size, comparable in size, I think, to the LSV mandate. And in contrast, our approach is a pure fundamental stock picking approach. Just a couple of 30,000-foot level of comments. There have been no changes to your investment team over the last year. And as Mike will detail for you, the investment team in this strategy is a group of five sub-teams, a team focused on Europe, a team focused on Japan, Pacific ex-Japan, Canada, and the emerging markets. Those folks come together collectively to add value for your portfolio. Your strategy has modestly outperformed over all periods on both a gross and a net basis. And that, again, dating back to May of 06. And then two things that Mike will be sure to highlight for you. I think two areas of prior concern for us and perhaps for yourself would have been the Japanese component of the portfolio and the emerging market equity portion of the portfolio. And both of those components have outperformed considerably over the last year, so we'll be pleased to share more details on that with you. And then for the balance of our brief time before you, I'll ask Mike to take you through maybe just a quick reminder on our investment process, since we don't see you every month and it's probably not memorized by everyone. And then he'll talk about the performance of the portfolio and the current positioning. Does that seem reasonable?
Okay, thank you, everyone. So why don't we turn first to page three, which Art mentioned. You know, this is the structure of the team. It seems like a very large team, but actually it's a quite practical way, from my perspective, to manage the portfolio. I'm Michael Strong, as Art said. I'm the lead portfolio manager for the portfolio. And working with my colleagues in the lead team in this top box here, Brian Hosley and Chris Stewart, my primary investment role is to determine the asset allocation between the different portfolio managers who actually choose the stocks. I've been a member of Fidelity's Global Asset Allocation Group for more than 10 years now, and that's a group of investment professionals who meet together on a regular basis to determine on a macroeconomic view, which particular regions of the world in terms of the equity markets do we like or dislike? You know, do we think that emerging markets are going to outperform the developed markets as they did last year? And as you'll see in a moment, we were actually overweight emerging markets in your portfolio relative to the benchmark. That would have been beneficial when emerging markets were up 80%+ relative to sort of 30-40% or 50% for the developed market. So that's my primary investment role. The actual stock selection is carried out by regional specialists. You know, if you look around the world, there are a huge number of stocks that you can invest in. And I think if you have a fundamental process as we do, which is concentrated primarily on the investment research we do, meeting thousands of companies every year, it's very hard for one individual to be an expert on the entire world. So what we do within this structure is we have managers respectively for Europe, Japan, the developed markets of the Pacific Basin, for Canada now as well, and for the emerging markets. So each of the individual portfolio managers is focused on and is a real expert on their region. And in most of the cases, if you look at this page, the managers are actually based in the region in which they're investing. So Cedric de la Chaise, as you can probably tell from his name, is actually French. He works in our London office, has worked there now for 13, he's into his 14th year. John Lowe is based in Singapore, he's responsible for the Pacific Basin part of the portfolio. Joe Overvest, who's a relatively new member of the team in terms of this mandate, is based in Toronto with the rest of our Canadian equity analysts. Fidelity, actually, in its broader sense, has a very big business in Canada, both on the institutional side, and we run a lot of mutual funds which invest in Canadian equities. Bob von Rakowski has been nearly 20 years at Fidelity, has always worked in the emerging market area. He's actually based in Boston. And then Eileen Dibb, who has been with the team about 2 years. Her predecessor was actually based in Tokyo, but for performance reasons, it was decided that we really needed to make a change to the management of that particular part of the portfolio. This was done 2 years ago. It was largely my decision along with our chief investment officer. And in fact, we found this lady, Eileen Dibb, who worked in another part of Fidelity, who speaks fluent Japanese, has lived in Japan, has been working on Japanese equities her entire career. But she happened to be based in Boston, and I felt she was the really outstanding candidate to take over this portfolio. And I'm encouraged by the initial results, certainly over the last 12 months. She seems to be doing very well, and we can talk a little bit more about that in a moment. But that's the basic team. We haven't lost anybody from the team in quite a while, as Art said. And I'm hoping to keep that team together for a long time. In terms of the broader Fidelity, there haven't been any major change in our ownership or in our leadership since we last actually met with you face to face. I think it's still, you know, a privately owned company where the Johnson family owns most of the, just under half the shares, in fact, and the rest are owned by the employees. And again, you know, the last 2 years, just as my colleague here from LSV said, you know, it's been pretty challenging in terms of asset management. Clearly, a lot of the portfolios in 2008 and through the beginning of 2009 lost a considerable amount of value. Within the institutional marketplace, we've enjoyed probably fairly neutral cash flows, I guess, over the last year, year and a half. Some clients, as the equity markets rebounded, have been rebalancing. And inevitably, you know, defined benefit plans, especially on the corporate side, are very mature, so you do see some cash demands to pay pensions, which after all is exactly what these funds are for. So no real surprises there. But in terms of stability and in terms of assets under management, I think the total assets under management within this strategy that you're investing in are now about $14 to $15 billion, and we have around 60 or so clients within the strategy, and that stayed fairly constant again over the last couple of years despite the market turmoil. So does anybody have any questions in terms of that before we go on to review perhaps the performance of the portfolio? Well, in the interest of time then, why don't we move to page 8? And this summary page, and I apologize for how busy it is and also for the size of the print, but as old as I am and your eyes are as tired, it gets quite difficult to read. I'll try and improve on it for next time. But what I do like to show is not only the performance of the portfolio at the top line, but also each of the sub-portfolios, because it helps me explain in detail how some of the performance has been generated. The left-hand column on this page shows you the returns for the most recent quarter, and then you see the annualized returns over the last 12 months, 3 years, and since inception. And as Art mentioned, you know, the assets at the end of March were just a fraction under $133 million. In the last quarter, the portfolio gross of fees is up just a fraction over 2%, which is just about, you know, a little under 0.5% ahead of the benchmark. And then if you look at the return in the next sort of block of numbers, that's the net return, the return net of fees, and it's about 30 basis points ahead of the index. If you look to the one-year numbers, as has already been said, you know, the last 12 months, obviously, it's been a very strong period for the equity markets. The portfolio is up 62%, which is just about 100 basis points ahead of the index. As has already been said, you know, value stocks outperformed growth stocks over the last year. Not really surprising, given how badly beaten down a lot of those companies were in terms of their share price in 2008 and going into 2009. As I say, with the growth orientation of this portfolio, the absolute returns not as high as you might see from a value manager, but I'm pleased to say that, you know, even net of fees, we did add some value during this period. You know, I hope that looking forward, and actually this has already started, we found that our stock selection has been working better this year, particularly in the last month or two, as I think investors are more focused on companies that can sustain their earnings growth, that will be able to generate improved margins. Last year, especially after March, What you saw was that a rising tide effectively lifted all boats, and, you know, especially in the financial sector, a lot of the banks looked as though they were actually going bankrupt. Of course, quite a few were actually taken over by governments, especially in Europe. And what you saw in 2008 and into early 2009 was that some of these European banks actually lost 80 or 90% of their value, not unlike, you know, a number of the American banks as well. But this year, we're beginning to see more of a focus on, as I say, companies that do have long-term potential. And, you know, the portfolio is tilted towards those companies where we think that earnings growth is going to be sustained. We don't want to have companies in the portfolio who are going to disappoint the market with their earnings this year, because we think investors are going to be much more discriminating than they were last year. So I suspect that if you do disappoint, your share price could get hurt pretty badly this year. And we can talk a little bit more in a moment about some more detail of what's actually in the portfolio. But over the last 12 months, what I would draw your attention to is just a couple of things. One is, if you look sort of down to the very bottom of this page, you'll see that the emerging market portfolio delivered almost 90% return over the course of the year, and was 7% ahead of the benchmark. That was very encouraging, because over the previous 2 years or so, our emerging market performance had been very, very disappointing, frankly. We had made some wrong calls on financial stocks, and some of the countries that we were investing in had not been good calls either, but things have improved significantly over the last 12 months, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. And the other thing is that it's also worth noting, as Art mentioned, I think, that if you go to the middle of this page, you can see the Japanese return. The portfolio was up just a fraction under 40%, which was nearly 2% ahead of the benchmark, and relative to the performance over the longer term, if you look at 3 and 5 years, you see that this portfolio has actually not added value. It's detracted from the overall performance of the portfolio. So having made that manager change, I am encouraged by what's happening within the Japanese portfolio in terms of the stock selection. But what you see is that actually Japan's absolute return was a lot lower than most of the other markets, particularly the emerging markets, and also the Pacific Basin. The Pacific Basin portfolio, that's the developed markets of Hong Kong, Singapore, and Australia. New Zealand's actually in there as well, but it's so small, there's few investment opportunities in New Zealand. That portfolio was up 90% last year. And what you saw was that that region was particularly benefiting from the fact that China started coming out of the recession in the fourth quarter of 2008, way ahead of the developed markets of the West, be it the US or Europe. And emerging markets, economies that were particularly exposed to raw materials, things and basic metals, really benefited from that. Consumption in China is improving. A lot of the region benefits from that as well. Countries like Hong Kong, Taiwan, Korea, for example. So what we saw was very strong rebounds in those particular equity markets. Europe has also been something of a laggard. And indeed, this year so far, Europe in dollar terms is showing negative returns, negative absolute returns. If I had a concern looking forward over the next 12 months about any particular region, it would have to be Europe. I've just come back from a trip actually to Tokyo, Beijing, and Hong Kong, a macroeconomic research trip. And looking closely again at the Japanese economy, I just fear that Europe could be heading the same way as Japan has for the last 20 years. Very little domestic demand growth, and in monetary policy that's actually too tight, heavy dependent on exports. There isn't a lot, and of course we've got the fiscal problems for some sovereign governments, particularly, you know, you've heard what's happened to Greece. That's had a very negative impact on the European market today. It's down 4% in dollar terms, and not surprisingly, given the concerns over Greece and some of the other peripheral European economies, the US dollar against the euro has strengthened today by, I think, something like 1.5% just on the day. And, you know, these problems, these fiscal problems that European governments have, aren't going to disappear quickly. So if you're ever thinking of taking a European vacation, the exchange rate might be as good as it's going to get for a little while this year. Just an observation. The other thing that we've done recently as well is we within your broad benchmark, it includes Canada and a lot of people south of the border, the Canadian border, tend to sometimes ignore Canada. I'm very pleased to have added some Canadian exposure to the portfolio recently. Canada is an interesting market. You know, it's a bit like, in some ways, it's a bit like some of the emerging markets. The economy is dominated by energy and raw materials. It's also got quite a big financial sector. But, you know, if we're going into a period of sustained global growth, driven obviously by what's happening in China and the emerging markets, the nature of the Canadian economy means it's probably going to do very well. And, you know, witness the exchange rate. You know, the US dollar and the loonie, the Canadian dollar, are actually virtually at parity today. Last week, I think it was, while I was away, the Canadian dollar actually briefly went above the US dollar on a comparable basis, down to 99 cents today, I think. But, you know, I do think the Canadian economy is going to continue to do well. The other thing about Canada is that the banking industry there is very conservatively managed. There was little or no exposure to the U.S. subprime market. So all of the Canadian banks, unlike their European cousins, are in a much healthier position relative to, you know, in regards to their balance sheets. So adding Canada, I think, will be helpful to the portfolio's absolute returns going forward. Does anybody have any questions on the broad returns before I talk in a little bit detail?
Your chart is very informative, but it's not net of fees. This is gross.
Yeah, the second block along is actually all net of fees.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very good.
Okay. Anybody else, please? All right. Why don't we talk a little bit about some of the stocks in the portfolio then that really have benefited the portfolio over the last 6 months or so, and some of those that have been a little bit more disappointing. So if you look at this top box, first of all, I'll explain what it shows. So if you look at the first column from the left, the portfolio average weights, that's just the weight of the stock within the portfolio over the period that we're looking at. The benchmark average weight is clearly the weight of the stock in the MSCI All Country World XUS Index. The relative weight shows you whether we were overweight or underweight that particular stock in the portfolio. And then you can see how that stock has performed relative to the broad index over the period that we're looking at. And obviously, you know, just for information, I've shown you which particular sector and which country that stock is in. So if we look at the biggest contributor over the last 6 months or so, it's a company called Fresenius, which is actually a German-based healthcare company that has it manages hospitals, it produces biotech products as well. It's done extremely well over the last 12 months. Doesn't have a huge exposure to the US, and obviously there are some concerns about the pricing for some of the pharmaceutical products given the new healthcare regime that we're all going to be enjoying very soon. Other companies that have done well for us, Rio Tinto. Actually, most of Rio Tinto's interests are in Australia. They're a very big mining conglomerate. But the stock is quoted in both the UK and in Australia. We happen to have held it in both parts of the portfolio. It was a big overweight within the European part of the portfolio. No surprises there. It strongly outperformed the market as demand for raw materials has grown from Asia. It was interesting, you know, my friend here talked about how his portfolio has actually been tilting slightly towards perhaps some more defensive growth companies. Well, Nestle, which is one of the world's largest food manufacturers, is a very good example of that. And, you know, Nestle's been a challenge for us because it has a tremendous brand, it has great range of products, but it's always been kind of expensive, and its growth has disappointed over a number of years. But last year, a new focus on getting rid of some of the less profitable brands, improvements in the and changes in management have actually encouraged people to think that that company can actually deliver now some very strong earnings growth. And that was indicated by the fact that it did outperform last year. Then, just in the interest of time, I'll focus on one area really that sort of let the portfolio down a little bit, because this is very much a contrast to the longer term. You know, we've got very good stock selection results from the European part of the portfolio in the long term. Over 3 years, the European manager has outperformed by something like 4% per annum. But last year was more challenging, and we actually did underperform slightly there. And really, it was down to our bank positions very largely and some of the other diversified financial companies that we owned. You know, in 2008, some of these stocks actually, people like HSBC, Intesa in Italy, and Crédit Agricole had done very, very well, as a lot of financial stocks in Europe were melting down because of their exposure to the US subprime business and also the UK mortgages. Banks like HSBC, Intesa, and Crédit Agricole, which didn't have much exposure to that particular part of the market, held up very, very well. But then in 2009, when a lot of those banks that had looked as though they were going over the cliff rather than just to the wall, really recovered and their stock prices more than doubled, these more defensive banking positions did underperform. For the long term, we still think these are very good positions to be in. But that was really a lot of the underperformance that we saw from Europe last year. Just turning to the next page, this shows you some of the sectors that outperformed for us during the course of the last 6 months or so, some of the detractors. No surprises, really, in terms of what I've just said, that one of the biggest contributors was the healthcare sector. We also did very well in capital goods as well, where some of the big engineering companies like Schneider Electric and Schindler in Switzerland, and some of the Japanese companies like Asahi Glass, who makes flat panel screens for televisions and computer monitors, did very, very well for us. What I would draw your attention to here, just sort of for information purposes, is this portfolio is very much driven on what we on the way we choose stocks. We have a lot of analysts around the world do a lot of research into individual companies. Most of the added value to the portfolio is going to come from the individual stocks, not by being overweight particular countries or sectors. And if you look at this, if you look down these columns, if you look at the second column from the left, what you see is that the biggest contribution generally is from stock selection, not from the industry selection. The latter, the industry selection, is whether or not being over or underweight the sector actually benefited the portfolio. Most times when you look at these attribution pages, I would hope that you would see the bigger numbers coming from stock selection, because that's how the process is focused. And to ensure the process continues to work, that's really one of the things I do look at. Does anybody have any question on the attribution? I'll talk for just a couple of minutes about the positioning of the portfolio. Okay. So if we turn to the next page, to page 11, you can see both the regional and the country allocation. I won't dwell too long on this. This shows the position at the end of March. And what you see if you look at the top box is that we were underweight Europe, close to neutral on the Pacific Basin, and a little bit overweight Canada, a little underweight Japan, overweight the emerging markets. Again, you know, I've already mentioned that I think that we are going to see a period of sustained growth. I think most of the drivers of global growth over the next year or two is going to come from Asia rather than from Europe. So again, I think that it's important to have more exposure to Asia and the emerging markets. I am very concerned about Europe, and particularly that, again, you know, the European economies, in order to benefit from global growth, are very much focused on export-driven businesses, very similar to Japan, especially countries like Germany, the Netherlands, Belgium, some of the Scandinavian countries. There's very little scope for the consumers to really drive growth in Europe. If you look back over the last 5 to 10 years, any consumer-led growth in Europe has not come from core Europe, it's come from the periphery, such as, I hate to say this as an Englishman, but the UK, Ireland, Spain. These are the countries now that are enjoying the highest level of unemployment. They've got the biggest level of government debt. Consumers, just like in the US, are actually reducing their overall debt level on a personal basis. So you're not going to see the same consumer growth for Europe that's come from those countries in the last 10 years. The unemployment in Spain, the official unemployment figures, are over 20%. The real level is probably significantly higher than that. And the position's not much better in countries like Portugal and Ireland, for example. So difficult positions. So that's basically how I see the portfolio going forward. I'm happy to take any more questions.
Do you see the EM overweight kind of a strategic overweight, given the structural challenges in Europe and in Japan and demographic issues there also, that this portfolio, the overweight EM, pretty much going forward?
I think there are good reasons why the next 10 or maybe 20 years you're going to see any global growth really driven from Asia and perhaps from India. So there are structural reasons to be overweight emerging markets. We don't try to make quick changes in the direction of the portfolio. I'm conscious of the fact whenever I sell down part of the portfolio to invest it elsewhere, there's a real cost associated with that. But what we should be looking at closely as well is what companies outside of the emerging markets are actually going to benefit from growth in those emerging markets. So, you know, I've just come back from Beijing, and the most common car, this is amazing, the most common car I saw there was an Audi, which is, you know, an upmarket European automobile. So, you know, we want to be very conscious of that as well. But given my concerns about Europe and the fact that Japan, I just don't see where any growth is coming from in Japan. I think you could see a structural overweight to emerging markets for quite a time.
Anything else? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We have SIS, Paul.
Just remember to change their graph.
All right. Thank
you. Oh, maybe it's the
same. Tell that to General Motors.
Like a great friend.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We
can
do the
March monthly phase themselves.
Market update. And you can see on the cover with the returns that March was another strong month, highlighted by small caps in the U.S. up over 8%, emerging markets over 8%, and then in fixed income, the high yield index up 3% plus. So once again, we see the riskier type of assets, the higher beta assets outperforming in a very strong up month. That did continue in April up till today. As was referenced earlier, the markets did sell off today, but prior to April, it had been another strong one. So we'll see how the next last few days of the month play out. The next page, the summary investments. Dan Sarah definitely has participated both on the downside and now on the upside. And on the upside, you can see the market value is up to $1.27 billion. We are right now in the process of doing a rebalancing away from equities to the new manager, PIMCO, in fixed income. A group of five equity managers is raising $75 million in cash to go to PIMCO right after the first of the month. Hopefully, some of them have already raised a little cash given what happened today. That would help us a little bit, too.
What did happen today? How bad was it?
As referenced, Europe was down 4%, and the U.S. markets were down roughly 2% today. Prior to today, though, the markets were up another 5%, 6%, 7%. So it's still a strong month, even with today. We've had, the markets being straight up for almost over a year now without any real meaningful correction. So it's not unexpected if we get a 5% to 10% correction here. If this is the start of it or not. It was mainly a reaction to, I think, two things, just the downgrading of the status of Greece in Europe, and, of course, politicians can't help themselves with reform, and there's a lot of talk of finance reform now, which are spooking the markets because the markets hate uncertainty, and once that's resolved, I think that will be taken off the table and the markets can continue on.
And there was a fear of rates rising as well, right, in the next few months?
The government's not going to raise. The markets might raise. The rates might be. The government's not going to raise short-term rates. The market might continue to have rates go up. Right. Yeah. Page two is the growth of assets. We can say growth these days. We're up $56 million from the prior month and $370 million from the prior year. That $900 million was about the low point. We went slightly below that level. As you recall, 1.5 was roughly the high point prior to the decline. So we've made good headway coming back, although obviously we're still below the height from a couple years ago. And that does include the monthly disbursements. Page 3, the allocations. This will change with PIMCO being added to fixed income and domestic equities being reduced. LSV will be reduced back to their 10% level. And page 4 breaks out cash with each of the managers, and cash remains at a low level. The SEC lending has improved slightly month to month and did improve slightly again in March. Page 5, the performance for the month of March. Equities were up 6.45 versus 6.3% for the Russell 3. Fiscal year date is now 9 months, 3 full quarters complete, roughly in line. The manager's 30.3 versus 30.5. Fixed income continues to perform well as spreads have continued to narrow. Dodge & Cox, being a spread manager, benefits from that, adding 100 basis points plus in the month of March and up 5.25% for the 9 months, roughly erasing what it had lost during the downturn. And in fact, it's made that back. And the two international equity managers who just presented collectively are both doing well this fiscal year to date, combined up 2.6% versus benchmark. Invesco does continue to lag slightly in these strong up markets. And then
slightly,
60 basis point. Yep.
This is worse than that.
Well, for the 9 months, 450, yep. We'll continue to watch them, but as you recall, the rankings are also very, very high, so it's been a hard index to beat. And lastly, the total fund, I mean, it's been good news. Up 4.87 versus 4.43 estimated for the policy, adding 44 basis points for March. And for the 9 months, 245 basis points ahead of policy. And roughly 150 of those basis points, or 60%, from Dodge & Cox fixed income. 50 basis points is from the international equity manager. So all in all, good news. Page 6 starts the rolling 3 years for Dodge & Cox equity. That's come back and it's kind of stabilized above the 0% level, so they have added value the last 3 years. Delaware made a little move up in the last month, is close to 0%. We would expect better from them, though. Luma sales seems to do a little better. They had a better month in March, although they went down slightly the last month because we rolled off a better month. And then LSV and Pyramus, the two international equity managers, followed by the volatile page 11 of Dodge & Cox fixed income. So with that, I'll take any questions, but I think our timing is pretty good to take some, you know, just a little bit of equity risk off the table by moving it to PIMCO, and also accomplishing a second fixed income manager to give us some diversification. I'll take any questions on performance.
What about that Invesco? I always had a question whether that was even a reason that I think that's the investment.
Well, I mean, it gives us a little diversification going to REITs. The absolute returns have been beneficial. The problem is the alpha hasn't been there. They've been lagging. I think being in REITs at 1.5% is okay from diversification. We talked about what we should do with them and decided not to up them to the full 3%. And some managers, just in straight up markets, because of their nature being a little more defensive, are not expected to outperform in this period. Although that said, we are a little disappointed at the level of underperformance.
How much money did we originally put in?
We put $20 million with them originally.
That was 18 months ago? 20 months ago?
I'd have to look that 18,
21 months ago, almost 2 years.
Over 2 years, out of January.
Over 2 years?
2 years.
So, if you put, Frank, you know, part of that's timing when we put it with them was right before the huge down period.
The good news is they made back some of the money. The bad news is they're not making as much as if we would have put in an index.
Yes, that's accurate.
So, my feeling is, let's get the heck out of that Dodge. It was my feeling a few months ago when we asked the question, I think it was, what, January, February, when we asked the question? We
talked about them then.
And I think it would be really a good idea to move out of that. If we want to diversify, let's diversify into a fund that's a index. Because we won't have the risk. And we won't have the fees.
I know it's on our due diligence agenda too, right, Tom, in June?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I would suggest we're going to do a due diligence at their offices in June, which is only 2 months away. So I would suggest let the due diligence committee visit them, and then we'll make a recommendation after that visit. It's only a couple months away.
Okay, discussion and action on actual review and analysis of June 30, 2009. The retirement board members received the final report from actuaries, EFI actuaries, Amy Schmidt and Bob McCrory. For the actual review and analysis of June 30, 2009, the board received the first presentation at the end of January and had subsequent meetings with actuaries and with public input on making some determinations on funding changes and so on, amortization. And this is the final report now showing the employer's contribution rates. This report does not reflect the over $20 million offset that this board has authorized from non-valuation reserves to offset employer contributions towards the unfunded liabilities because the actuaries are not comfortable with including that within their report. But we will be taking this report with the offset and presenting that to the Board of Supervisors during the month of May for the contribution. So this is a report on page one that shows the $48.5 million estimated employer contributions. That is gross. The net amount will be closer to $28.5 million after the $20 million offset that the board authorized. Outside of that, the report is fairly comprehensive. It shows both benefits, also statistics on membership, etc. Because Wes Hall isn't here, I just happened to notice one little minor typo. which doesn't mean anything or go anywhere, but on page 41 of the due to disability, option number zero, the unmodified, is 100% continued to the spouse, not a 60%. And the verbiage on 13, they are correct in showing 100%. It just didn't carry over into the tables. Other than that, I would certainly recommend that the board receive, adopt, and accept these rates as recommended contribution rates for the employers at this point in time, so that we can forward this to the Board of Supervisors and begin charging these rates in fiscal year 2010-2011.
Have a motion. I'd like to read to the 79 pages first.
Motion to approve this.
We're waiting for a motion.
Second.
So we have a motion and a second. Discussion.
Darren, were you the second?
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. I have a concern about the assumption rate. Can you tell me what page that's on? Since
we have what page?
Large document here.
The assumption rate is the 8.16%.
It's on page 43, summary of assumptions.
43. Yeah, summary of actual assumptions, page 43.
I know we're pretty far down the time frame here to make any adjustments to this, and it's been discussed in the past. But I think next year we need to take a very close look at that. Next year we'll have the pony up, if you will, and we have the three-year review. And I think that the assumption rate is a problem. I don't think we can sustain that rate. And we are near the top, not the top, but we are near the top of the assumption rates in the state. And given the fact that a lot of those are maybe influenced by political action, I'm concerned about this in the future. One of the problems that we have on the assumption rate is broken into components. And I think we had a critique of that in the actuarial audit. And in that audit, it suggested that we drop our rate. So hopefully we can take a close look at this for next year.
Tom, clarify for me, within the last 12 months, we had a committee of this board review the assumption, and part of that review process was our actuaries participated in that. Is that correct?
That's correct. The actuaries, investment consultant, investment managers, and I believe about five other 1937 X systems.
And the report back to this board was to
maintain
it in our current rate, but to bring it back for review at a later date based upon our returns that we're seeing.
Right.
Okay.
Kind of a tenuous recommendation.
I guess we're in a tenuous situation.
Point of clarification that, you know, contrary to what some may believe, you know, this board is looking at these things. Mm-hmm. And you know, we bring other people to the table and we are reviewing these things because, yes, it is going to be a problem going forward, I think. But as long as we're doing our job, our fiduciary responsibility, and studying these things and bringing other people into the process, I think we're fine. Yeah. So.
That is correct. Any other comments?
Our rate of return right now is
8.16.
It's 8% compounded to 8.16.
Right. It's been that for years.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's 1990, I think.
And
that's going to be part of our discussion, I'm sure, during our strategic planning the next couple of days, because at the last strategic planning, that's where we decided basically to form the subcommittee that reviewed that specifically. Mm-hmm. So, again, for the last 3 years at least, then we'll have a chance this next couple of days to re-look at that, mm-hmm. maybe schedule a time frame for when we want to re-look at this. And, again, part of it will be, you know, based on a lot of the stuff that we've gone through and expect to go through and so forth. Because every action has consequences, and we need to make sure that we are set to deal with those consequences.
If I read this report right, our rate of return this fiscal year is 24%.
In the first 9 months,
yeah.
But it's 10 years through December 31st, 2009 is 5.5, so.
Yeah, the long term is better. But that's kind of a blip, too, when you take the long term.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Only if you don't consider the entire world who took the blip with us.
There's a graph for tomorrow's meeting, and it's from 1990, I believe, forward, and it averages out to 8.9. So yeah, it just exactly. depends on when you take the picture.
Exactly.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah,
exactly.
Okay. So with that, we have a motion and a second. Last chance. Any further discussion? Okay. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Okay. So moved. With that, we go to renewal of our consultant's contract.
Okay.
Should Paul be refused from this? I think you should be. Paul, if we're going to be discussing your contract with the board.
Sure. Do you want me to go over my memo at all or not?
No, I think you should go over your memo, but okay. I think if we're going to be voting on this,
sure.
I think you should refuse yourself.
Okay.
Thank you.
No worries.
Okay.
I'll go over the memo quickly and then recuse myself. As you recall, we brought this up, I think, at the last meeting, the contract, and part of this ongoing discussion has been how the board can properly evaluate their investment consultant. And in that regard, we were asked to present a memo, and obviously you have to take the source of this memo in this discussion. But the memo basically says that I believe there's three measurements on how you can properly measure an investment consultant. And in that area is just the forms. Two of them are kind of qualitative, black and white, and one's more quantitative, gray area. And the first measurement we bring forth is just how the total plan's doing versus their policy index, which would be made up of passive indices. And we just had a discussion on the REIT manager, and that's part of the overall component. And you can see as at 12/31/2009, we present how the plan has done versus the policy index. And if we, again, as Hank just said on, you know, it's very much time dependent and where you start and where you end. And if we looked at this a year ago, it would look a lot different than it does this year. And that's why we kind of caution, look at more longer term. A year ago, I was very, very stupid. And today, I look a lot smarter. And the truth is probably somewhere in the middle, like most cases. But over 10 years, this plan has added 230 basis points. And that is great. That is really significant. And I think the board deserves obviously the credit, and I'm along with the ride. The second measurement is potentially how your investment consultant can save costs to the plan. And primarily that's in negotiating fees with managers. And we like to say that our firm, when we negotiate or renegotiate fees with the manager, it's not only your assets, it's our total firm's assets behind you. And I think that's an advantage. And we, you know, mentioned in the memo a few cases where we believe we've added value in that area. Also, in rebalancing is another area that you can watch us on. And we put the most recent rebalances during this financial crisis towards the end. We had let the fixed income allocation go above its target recall. And we purposely let that drift up to the point where we became pretty uncomfortable with that. And then here's a analysis of the rebalances. And as you recall, about a year ago, Mike Lynch had us do this, and it didn't look as good. But in the end, when times were the most uncomfortable, that's when you probably should be rebalancing away from the asset class into the asset class that has been underperforming. And that served us well. And the third measurement is kind of the qualitative gray area, and that's you as a board meet with me on a monthly basis, at least once a month, and it's just how you judge how I'm doing my job. Now, what we can do and what other funds do with me is on an annual basis, they have a questionnaire that they give to each of their board members on various areas to kind of rate how their investment consulting's doing, what they would like to see out of them, what they're not seeing, that type of thing. If the board deems that necessary, you could start that, an annual type of questionnaire on the investment consultant or the actuary or whoever, or whatever vendor you want to do. I mean, I can help show you what the other fund is doing as far as their questionnaire, because it's a public fund, it's public information. And with that, I will stop. I'll take any questions if necessary. I don't think there are, and just excuse myself. I would like to just remind the board on the contract itself, it's pretty much the same contract as the previous one. Tom made some good changes, I think, to it, along, you know, with the attorney reviewing it. They're very minor changes. And again, the fee we're proposing for the first year of the three-year contract is exactly the same fee as the last year of the prior contract. And that's just me recognizing the situation out there, what this fund and every fund is going through. And frankly, I just think it's not right to raise a fee at this time. For year two and year three, we're proposing increases of $2,500 a year over the previous year. It's a modest increase, I believe. And I'll excuse myself.
Well, before you leave, I think there's a fourth measurement, too, that's not here, and that's education and training of the board. And I think Paul and SIS have done that. And just to finish my comment, we can't blame SIS for failed opportunities, you know, that this board has passed on. So I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, Paul. We'll let you know when you come back in. If you wouldn't mind shutting the door. Thank you.
Promise, my ear won't be long.
Okay, you have the contract before you, the 2010 to 2013. You also received Paul Hart's evaluation that he was asked to present, which he was presented to you. The due diligence visit in 2008 to SIS, you have a copy of that. You've been able to review that. The prior contract, three-year contract with them from 2007 to 2010, and also Greenwich reports a couple of articles in choosing investment consultants and things to consider in that choice. So you have all that material. As Paul Hart mentioned, there were just some minor changes from the prior contract. Fred Silva had given us some additional triggers for automatic termination, such as sale, liquidation, receivership. Some additional language on for Stansera to approve on the professional consultant. Any changes to the professional consultant. There is a change between the prior contract and this one in the backup. Being Patrick Thomas was the prior backup, and this under this contract will be Herschel Shaw. There was, in Section 9, the professional liability insurance was increased from $1 million to $2 million. That was Phil Silva's suggestion, as well as an additional language on disclosure of conflicts in Section 17. And as Paul Hart mentioned, of course, the fees, no change for the first year, and then $2,500 each year increase for the second and third years. So very minor changes in the fees with no change in the first year. With those changes, I would certainly recommend the board adopting a new three-year contract for Strategic Investment Solutions as their investment advisor.
Tom, if I may, my only concern is that I don't think this version of the agreement is the one you were referring to. This version that was, because I just looked reading it when Paul was speaking, mm-hmm. And I don't see my changes that were made on here. And I see that Deidre is still listed as the Deputy County Counsel. I think this is just an old. I think this is an old draft.
There was a
2007. This is the one. That's, okay.
That's the 2007, 2010.
This is the one that's the old one. What's the
was also sent.
Is the new one on here too?
Yes.
It's attached to this memo.
It's attached to the memo.
Tom's memo.
It's
the first
memo.
One.
Okay, I don't think I got that one.
Oh.
I think that's the problem.
It should have been the very first one.
I don't have that.
Here you go.
Yeah.
Okay, there's one for 2010 to 2013.
So I was looking at the old one. Okay.
I did the same thing today. I was looking at it. I looked at you and I went back up.
Okay, I see my language.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, sure. Thank you.
I'll move for approval.
Second.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Additional discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, so moved.
Thank you.
Paul,
you
know,
we
can say three more years.
Three more years.
Thank you.
Yeah. You made that motion when you hired him.
Yeah. I think you said that before.
Not his fault. We lost all that money.
It's now a hysterical document.
Cleaning lady said she'll help you move out.
Okay, Paul, congratulations. So you've been contracted to remain a consultant for the next 3 years. Yeah,
thank you very much.
Okay, and then we have, let's see, where are we? Now, all of everything under B was relating to the contract.
Right.
Okay, and we go to correspondence and a letter from Dennis Mandrawi.
Members, board members received copies of the email from Dennis Mandrawi, two pages questioning investments, investment losses, and so on. And I believe Paul Hart has a response, a verbal response to that.
It's only appropriate that my first act after the retainer. First of all, I would say, does the board wish me to respond or not?
I'd like to hear you respond.
I move no.
I think that, you know, this is an interesting issue, but one that could get a fund in a lot of trouble if done the wrong way. And you think of our investment managers, I would say they're all beta managers. I mean, they're tied to the asset class that they represent. Now, if they're index funds, they're pure beta. And if they're active managers, their job as hires, they add a little alpha to that beta. But we have a very recent experience where the markets were in free fall, and that's what this person's concern is, and that's a good concern to have. The issue is, though, if you set a stop loss on a manager, i.e. on the beta that they represent, basically, you could get stopped out of the market at the absolute bottom or very close to the absolute bottom and then miss a huge, powerful rally in a short period of time. And as we all know, in watching the markets over the years, 90% of a return from an asset class over a year period can happen in just 10 days or 20 days of the whole year, and that could happen altogether. So we could have had a 20%, 25%, 30% stop loss on any one of our managers, been stopped out about a year ago, a little over a year ago, right towards the bottom, and then missed some or all of this huge 70% rally in equity. You have to have a policy. When do you get back in after you get stopped out? And you get whipsawed in that too. It's just a very dangerous policy to even consider, I think. Now, where this is applicable, I think, too, is where you would have absolute return managers with 0% type benchmarks. A currency alpha manager, for example. We have one at San Joaquin where we have stop losses on. Or a hedge fund type, absolute return hedge fund manager with LIBOR as their benchmark. And you only would allow that manager to have a loss of dollar terms of a certain amount. And if you got below that level, that's when you could stop them out. But I think for the way our plan is set up and with the beta exposures, it's just an area I would feel very uncomfortable to even go into. And I suspect many of you would feel the same way.
I think one of the stop-loss measures that we already have, that it's automatic that we put a manager on watch when they start showing comparisons to their index.
And we do that when on a quarterly basis along with the
performance.
Yeah.
So we're watching those managers regularly.
Totally. You know, yeah, exactly. But it's hard. I'm just talking more on the market as a whole and kind of asset class level.
Well, I think the other thing is the whole theory of market timing. It's probably what he was talking about, and that's the difficult thing,
yes.
Market time.
Yeah,
and I think there's a lot of research on that.
And I just, can you imagine the headline risk of a plan that did something like that incorrectly? It would just be huge. I'll stop there.
Good. Thank you.
The one thing I noticed that wasn't obviously taken into consideration is the cost associated with that. So even if we staying with the type of system that we have, anytime you divested yourself of anything, there's a cost associated with that, which would only compound it. So there really isn't a place where, you know,
I mean, I would rather prefer to buy puts on equities as an insurance type of thing than do this type of thing.
Well, sometimes that process takes months because you can't dump into the market. You dump in the market, you're going to lose
profit. Create part of problem.
We did that when we pulled out of the international one. The Putnam. Is a large amount there, and it took months to move that money.
Yes.
And then we didn't take it all. There were different managers we've had over the years, and we just absorbed into other funds that transferred the stock to themselves.
Now, one unrelated thing I wanted to say was on the actuary rate assumption. We're hearing, and it's rumors, so take it for what it's worth, that GASB is considering implementing a new policy where plans actuary rate would be calculated as follows. What if you're below 100% funded, then your whatever your funding ratio is, say 80%, that would be calculated at your actuary rate return of 8.16%, for example, for this plan. The 20% in that example that you're underfunded would be calculated based on a treasury curve or a much lower rate, and then that would be combined, which would have the effect of lowering your actuary rate by a little bit, depending on how underfunded you are. So that's just something we're hearing about, and we're talking out with Bob McCory at EFI, just to watch, but potentially that, if implemented, would have implications in lowering the actuary rate assumption, which, as Maria also stated, would have other implications. So.
But I'm curious, is this an opportunity for us to get some additional education, just to basically better educate the board on items related to this?
Well,
that doesn't necessarily mean we're going to do anything,
no.
Change anything, but simply to understand what the larger scope of these things are.
That's something I think Bob does a good job on that on an ongoing basis, but if that's an area there the board has questions, then, you know, Bob could probably do that for you. He's very capable.
Something for us to consider.
It's just something I've heard a couple different places. So,
what does the rumor say about when Gatsby may be doing this?
I think, I don't know.
Whenever they get around to it.
They put things out for comment. It takes quite a long time before it really goes through the system. So
I might be retired by now. Oh, except for the market today. Thought I was closer. But anyways.
Though you may be retired, you still have your money in the system.
Anyways, so there's no... is this an action item?
No.
Okay. So basically at this point, I don't think we really have a response from Mr. Masrawi. We looked at his letter. We
discussed it.
We discussed it. And I don't think there's pretty much anything else we can do at this point. So I'm not recommending that we do anything beyond this.
Okay.
So with that, we go on to standing committees. And Mike Lynch isn't here.
Well, I could say something on
okay.
this.
Okay. Oh, that's right.
This is someone had expressed interest in attending, and the only cost would be travel. And that's it, really. The registration fee is complimentary, and it's quite steep. It's like, I don't know, $2,495, but it would be waived. So it would just be costs. You'd be approving attendance and travel costs.
And I'm the one that's interested in attending, having reviewed the information and confirmed there was no cost associated with it besides just the travel. I thought it might be a good opportunity because I'm pretty cheap that way. So what think y'all?
I move for approval.
Is there a motion?
Second.
Okay. Okay, we have a motion and a second. Do we have any further discussion? This would be open to anyone else besides me who would like to attend. Okay. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, so moved.
I'd go, but I still have jet lag.
Jet lag.
Okay, with that, we will, it's time to go into closed session.
Move we go into closed session.
We have a motion. Do we have a second?
Second.
Okay. We're back in open session. You got that, Joyce? Okay. Report out.
Report.
All right. That takes us to a members forum.
So Fred, nothing to report.
Nothing.
Nothing.
I have nothing.
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 All right. I think we're
adjourned.
Thank you all.